Isaiah was the founder of the school. Isaiah had disciples. These disciples had disciples that studied first his teachings. They matured. And then one of the greatest students of Isaiah went into the exile hundreds of years later in Babylon, carried the seed of his thought and his theology into the exile. And there in that experience, the thinking of the school of theology matured more. After the exile, more thought into this school. And finally, all of this thinking, the accumulation of the Isaiah school over the years, was put into one book, and it was called Isaiah. Now, why do I make the assumption that this was somewhat of a school that had a definite identity? I make that assumption because there is a book of Isaiah, and it's called Isaiah, and it covers hundreds of years and many, many authors, that some committee somewhere must have decided this is our way of thinking, this is our school of theology, let's gather it all together in one collection and let's call it after our founding father of our theological school, Isaiah. But mainly two authors. And then there'd be many others besides that, but the main author would be Isaiah himself, and then the second main author would be someone whom we do not know his name. He's been called exotic names like Second Isaiah or Deutero Isaiah. And we know this through the detective work into the book, that especially Isaiah 55 on, reflects a totally different historical setting than the first part of the book of Isaiah. Okay, are there any other questions about that? I could give you a detail of how the, if you would be interested on the board tomorrow, I could give a detailed guess as to how the book of Isaiah is divided according to authorship. I don't have that prepared today, but if anybody's
interested tomorrow.
Okay. Yeah, so I'll just list what chapters we, and you always have to remember this is guesses. Some is more definite than others. I'll list that tomorrow. Now today I have five things to cover in these 5 days. One, I just want to look at the founder of this school of theology, Isaiah, and his call and some of his teachings. Tomorrow I want to look at two of the great encounters he had with the kings of Judah and the meaning of those encounters. And out of those encounters came a lot of Handel's Messiah, out of those kingly encounters. And then the next day I want to move all the way to the time of the exile or the Babylonian captivity, and look at the ministry and the teaching of the person we call Second Isaiah. And then the fourth time, move into the real maturing of Second Isaiah's thought in the servants' songs. And then the last day, look at how Jesus and the early church found their understanding and their identity in the school of Isaiah. And therefore, I will then state the premise that the early church really was a revival of the school of Isaiah, and then ask the question, will we be willing in our churches to carry on the theological school of Isaiah in our own lives and in our own parishes? That isn't much to do in 5 days. And I need, in order to reach that final point, to run through these five steps. So what I'll never finish any of the steps these 5 days, so what we'll do is we'll just go as far each time, and then the next session I'll just tell you in 5 minutes what we didn't talk about. Then we'll move on to the next step, or else we would end the fifth day and only be halfway through with what I see as a real logical process here in 5 days. So also I want to say this to make you feel free to ask questions and add comments. Because if we don't finish, like I say, we'll just have a quick summary of what we didn't finish the next time and go on. So don't hesitate to raise questions, clarifications, add your own insights as we move along. I cannot study any part of the Bible without getting it all figured out in my mind how it all fits together. Thus the chart, this very complicated chart. And it starts on the side that says 760, the year 760 at the top. And as we talk these 5 days, the school of Isaiah really developed and grew during this most turbulent time in the history of the Israelite people. And so this will keep us in touch with what was going on in their history at that time. At the top, first is Egypt on one side, and then the two kingdoms, Judah, the southern kingdom, Israel, the northern, and then the great powers of the world, Assyria, Babylon, and Persia. And then the final gives a little, it tells you where the Old Testament prophetic books fit into this history, but especially the life of Isaiah and the school of Isaiah along that last time chart. So if you keep this in your hand during the 5 days, we'll be referring back to it often. Now, I want to set for a few moments now the historical situation into which Father Isaiah was called to preach, to minister, to gather disciples, and to found a seminary. I want to give a little background before this chart here starts. The first understanding, the kingdom. Remember the three great kings, the founding kings of Israel. What are their names? Remember?
Saul,
David, and Solomon. Solomon. Let's get it mixed up with Solomon's head of Christ. Solomon. Saul, David, Solomon. This was a time of a united kingdom, a united monarchy. Then in the year 931, after the death of Solomon, was a division of the kingdom. It was really like if our north and our south would have divided at the time of the Civil War. After that point, two separate kingdoms of people that are of the Jewish or the Hebrew faith, the north and the south. The capital of the north, Samaria, the capital of the south, Jerusalem. Now, just that was in the year 931, and then our chart here starts in the year 760. And I won't say a lot to fill in that time period between the division of the kingdom and the beginning of our chart, except it was a constant up and down between Yahweh worship, the God of Israel, and idolatry, and following the cults around them. And also during this period, we had such greats as such great people as King Ahab and his lovely wife Jezebel, and the great work of the prophets Elijah and Elisha. Remember the story of the prophet and the priests of Baal on the mountaintop, reflecting this constant back and forth between Yahweh worship and worship of the gods of the land, the Baals. Sometimes the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom were friends. Other times they were enemies. Sometimes they fought each other. The northern kingdom probably had less times of reform of Yahweh worship than the southern kingdom, because the southern kingdom was tied to the temple worship in Jerusalem. Now I want to move to these two long-term kings of both kingdoms that you'll find at the top of your chart. And it's important to get this now, because the first verse of Isaiah 6, where Isaiah talks about when he began his ministry, he says, in the year that, remember? Yeah. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne high and lifted up. Let's briefly look at what life was like during the long reigns, and you see you have two long reigns of Uzziah, 783 to 742, Jeroboam, 786 to 746. The reason Jotham goes up into Uzziah's reign a little there is that Uzziah became a leper and he still ran the country, but his son Jotham was kind of the figurehead that would meet the public because Uzziah could not with his leprosy. But the historical situation at this time that the two... I have a little map up here on the board, but this, if you remember from school, the Fertile Crescent. Here's Egypt, you know, and here's the two great rivers with their two great cities, Babylon and Nineveh. And now during the times of Uzziah and Jeroboam II, both Egypt and the areas here were weak. In other words, they were not world powers. They were in decline. And it was like how Russia and the United States affect all the smaller countries in the world today. You know, every small country is somewhat determined by what Russia and the United States are doing. And I think a dream of the small countries in the world is that Russia and the United States would both become weak so we could finally kind of run our own business and not have the two elephants either fighting or making love in our grass. And this was the situation during these two long reigns that the great conflicting power areas in the world were both weak, and that allowed the smaller countries that were always run over in the middle to kind of work out their own lives for a few years. And so what they did is there was peace. They had great military establishments to protect themselves from each other, you know, what you might call a balance of power. And then they worked out tremendous trade arrangements around the world. They had two fairly stable, good kings. So there was a political stability. There was economic growth. There was strong defense, and there was peace because the powers of the world weren't bothering them. You know, it was a time to just kind of sit back, and for a few years, we can just have a good time running our little countries. And they were good, good times. They were times when people prospered, times when there was trade and business, and people were getting richer and richer. They were called the good times. The good times. Now, there was one flaw in the good times, more so in the northern kingdom than in the southern kingdom, but it was a matter of degree, that without doing this, you would have had this much wealth, which wasn't bad, but by doing this, you had this much wealth. And that was the people who were making it the best started exploiting the poor. And therefore, while part of the populations of the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom were becoming wealthier and wealthier and wealthier, their economic growth now was a result of, as Isaiah says, pushing the face of the poor into the dirt. Now, how did one do this? There were two ways to do this, and they mastered them both, again, especially in the northern kingdom, but it was a matter of degree. The way they did this was, one, when your neighbor ran into hard times, take his land over. It was called land expansion at the expense of somebody else, and then you can turn him into a renter or a tenant farmer. Now, the law, the ancient Mosaic laws of Israel had ways to stop this from happening. And so you would say, well, then the poor people or the person now that's disadvantaged, what do? You go to the gate, to the court, and you bring your case before the judges or the elders of the town in the court. And of course, then they'll open up the Mosaic law, and they see that they have been wronged according to the Mosaic law, and they'll get their land back. Wrong. Simply, the rich now, and you'll see this in the book of Isaiah, and more specifically in Amos, you pay off the judges. It's called bribery. And now once the poor have no recourse, at this point they have no place to go. They have no place to turn to because the courts of justice now are paid off. Then there are many other ways you'll see in the Old Testament scriptures. Like in the marketplace, phony scales to take advantage of the poor, and things like this. So it was a time when everybody could have been well off, but the people that took advantage found a way that they could even be better off at the expense of some of their other people in their own country. Now, if both our task and also the danger in looking at these times is comparing them with our own. And I think of this in relation to a story. I remember once my father caught me breaking a pencil. And my father went almost out of control. He never ever went out of control. This is very close in being angry. And finally, when we talked it through, he said that during his childhood, he and his sister Doris were given one pencil a year, which they sawed in two. And that was to last them for the entire year. Now, our problem in our home in Albuquerque is we drown in pencils. At the church, we get boxes of 500 pencils, and I always get them in my pocket and carry them home. And when Karen gets 300 gathered at home, she puts rubber bands around them and ships them back to the church. Now, I'm using this illustration of my father, the one pencil a year, sawed in two to share with his sister, and my drowning in pencils at home to really show how we have moved during the last 30, 40 years in our country. I go on confirmation retreats, and we stop at a store, and I see these kids pulling out $5 bills and $10 bills and filling their pockets with candy and treats and goodies, and have grown up to just expect that there's always money and there's always more, and more. And we still expect that. And I see our whole national mood today with what's called Reaganomics is a whole nation that's depending on this one man to get things moving again. Our dreams are with this man, our hopes and our aspirations that somehow the 1 to 500 pencil life will continue to a 30,000 pencil life. And we hide ourselves from the fact that this too is based on the poor of the world having less and less and less and less. Now again, we don't want to draw perfect parallels, but I think we have to keep this in mind or keep this on a shelf as we move into the book of Isaiah. Now, what happened at the time when Isaiah comes to power? I mean, not comes to power, starts a seminary. What is happening in the world? Everybody thinks this kind of period of wealth will go on forever and ever. But one person is sensitive that something is happening in the world. And that is what Isaiah sees is off here in Nineveh. And this can be very contemporary. This is modern Iran. A threat in Iran. The rise of the great founder of the Assyrian Empire, his full name is Tiglath-Pileser III, but we're going to call him Tig, or Tiglath. And now Tiglath is spreading already the Assyrian Empire. And it's growing and is defeating enemies. And Isaiah can see this coming. And Isaiah, being of a prophetic and a sensitive historical mind, is saying the fun is over. The fun is over as Tiglath is moving closer and closer and closer. And it is in that context now.
Question.
Yeah.
Is Isaiah in the northern or the southern kingdom?
Okay, Isaiah is in the southern kingdom. The great prophets in the northern kingdom of about the same time, a little earlier, would be Amos and Hosea, during the same kind of time of prosperity. Amos and Hosea in the northern kingdom now. Isaiah in the southern kingdom. Let's turn now to Isaiah 6. And this is the call of Isaiah. And it starts in the year of King Uzziah's death. And Isaiah saw what was going wrong is one, Uzziah was dying, a strong king, being replaced by his son Jotham, who was weak, an ineffective king. And Isaiah was saying, and then Isaiah saw Tiglath coming from the north and saying, my goodness, at the very time when we need strong leadership, the world is going crazy and we're stuck with this king, Jotham. So that's the situation now as Isaiah is called. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord Yahweh seated on a high throne. His train filled the sanctuary. Above him stood two seraphs, each one with six wings, two to cover his face, two to cover his feet, and two for flying. The exact Hebrew of the two to cover his feet were really two to cover his genitals. But I wanted to add that the Bible over the years retranslates things so we aren't embarrassed. Okay, now I embarrass myself. And these angels or these seraphim, they cried out one to another in this way, holy, holy, holy is Yahweh Sabaoth. His glory fills the whole earth. Now this is a temple experience, and we'll find as we read Isaiah that he's a person of the temple in Jerusalem. And the vision here is the rooms of the temple, the altar of incense in the temple. The foundation of the threshold shook with the voice of the one who cried out, and the temple was filled with smoke. And I said, what a wretched state I am in. I'm lost. I'm a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. Now my eyes have looked at the King, Yahweh Sabaoth. Then one of the seraphs, these are the angels that were on the Ark of the Covenant, flew to me, holding in his hand a live coal which he had taken from the altar with a pair of tongs. With this he touched my mouth and said, see now, this has touched your lips. Your sin is taken away, your iniquity is purged. Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I go? Who will be our messenger? And I answered, who will go into this mess that's coming when this nation is going to fall apart and everybody's dreams and aspirations of things getting better and better are going to be destroyed? Who will go and preach? Now, as a minister of the gospel, I would run 1,000 miles away. Who will go into this situation? And Isaiah, now called by Yahweh, forgiven, touched, says, here I am, send me. Now we usually end this chapter with that verse because it's glorious, but now Yahweh tells Isaiah, I'm sending you out there to fail.
Is that a vision or
is that something you experienced? We don't know. It's obviously a vision of some sort that Isaiah had in the temple, because it's all related to temple worship in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't completely answer it. Exactly how this vision came to him. Then this is the word then that comes to Isaiah the next. Go and say to this people, hear and hear again, but do not understand. See and see again, but do not perceive. Make the heart of this people gross, its ears dull, shut its eyes, so that it will not see with its eyes, hear with its ears, understand with its heart, and be converted and healed. Yahweh is sending Isaiah to this people now and says, you're going to preach to them, and they're not going to listen. In fact, you're going to close their ears. Would most of us say, okay, Lord, I quit. I quit before this begins. So then Isaiah asks, how long, O Lord, how long? And then the answer, until towns are laid waste. Okay, so with this encouraging beginning now, Isaiah goes forth to preach. And how would you feel if you were Isaiah at this point? He certainly didn't have any, like, Kiwanis Citizen of the Year Award, would he? I think here in Isaiah we might have the first vision of the Christ. That now as Isaiah goes out really to fail, you have the same picture of Jesus in confidence marching to the cross. You know, and it means now Isaiah's trust is totally in God. You know, totally in that he will be faithful to God. And not his work now and his life's work will never be dependent, you know, on how it works. He will, and we'll read that, how he sees the ultimate and the final victory, even if it's beyond his lifetime. You know, he sees a vision, you know, which again, I mean, that comes right back to us. Is my life is the movement of my life dependent on what effect I will see in 2 years or the final vision of God's kingdom? That is what we call hope, living by hope. And that's what we'll look at next tomorrow when we talk about his two great royal encounters. Okay, the other one was the other one that we'll talk about is later. The first one is Ahaz, and the second one is Hezekiah. And there are two different kings that he encounters, and again, we'll just wait until tomorrow with that. But, okay.
Yeah, the feeling that God won when it was yours.
Mm-hmm. Right, God and one. Be one way to say it. God and one are a majority. And now when Isaiah went forth to preach now, and then obviously too in working through his school then that put his writings together, we can find what I've called five main themes in his preaching. And I'd like to just spend our last time here today looking at five examples of that. First, that injustice or taking advantage of the poor is apostasy. It's an act of leaving the faith of Yahweh to oppress the poor. Okay, the second is that plain church is futile. It's not going to help. Or external cult is futile. Third is the overpowering message of the forgiveness of Yahweh. Yahweh is standing around as you're as you're worshiping other gods, taking advantage of the poor. Yahweh is just standing there with his heart aching to forgive you. Then the message that destruction will come, not destruction may come, but then a word of hope. That the destruction will be God purifying the people and calling forth out of the destruction a little remnant, and out of that remnant will grow the glorious destiny for Zion and for Jerusalem and for the people of Israel. Okay, now the question that the Isaiah school will struggle with through the next couple of hundred years, and the answer that they finally reach that taught Jesus and taught the disciples will be this question:
by what means does the glorious kingdom come to the world? How does it come? It's going to hold that question in your mind, because through tomorrow and the next days and up till Friday, we're going to answer that question. How does the glorious kingdom that Isaiah describes and Isaiah hopes for, how does it come about? Okay, now let's, just for fun, let's look at some examples of these different themes. First, the theme, injustice is apostasy. And to understand that, I have to just briefly say how the covenant faith understood injustice. When God called the people out of Egypt, brought them into the promised land, the covenant understanding is this, as I see it, that God, and I'm making a faith statement here, we, as biblical people, we live with the humor of thinking we know what God was thinking. Okay, you get that? Okay, we live with the humor of thinking we know what God was thinking. Another way of saying we believe in revelation. God called a people out of this world, and he wanted this people to live differently than all the other people of the world, in order that the other people would see the way they live, and that would be the light to show them how God wants his whole creation to live together. And the covenant is this, this promise between God and his people that included the giving of the law, the setting up of the way of life, of the ritual, the temple, and the worship was this, that I want to form and keep a people who will be different than all other people on the earth, because this people in their life and in their relationships will live what we would call shalom living, as a way of showing the rest of the world how God Almighty wants the whole world to live. That's as simply as I can state it. Now, in the Mosaic laws, this shalom living took on very definite forms, especially economically. The first was that the land that you receive doesn't belong to you. It would be unheard of in the covenant to say, my property. You know, or post, no trespassing. Nobody owns anything. The land is a gift and on loan, and it belongs to Yahweh. Therefore, how could you sell land or buy land? When the people move into the promised land, the vision is this, that each family will have an equal share of the land in order to raise the food for their own needs. And no one will ever become really rich and nobody really poor, but everybody will have what they need. And the reason for this is that because you are a people different than all other people, your purpose in life is not to become wealthy at the expense of someone else. Your purpose in life is to worship Yahweh. And that's your number one goal in life, is to worship Yahweh and then get along with each other. Worship Yahweh and get along with each other. So now when... this is why injustice is breaking the relationship with God, breaking the understanding of how God wants his people to live. And now let's look at some of Isaiah's preaching on that. Look in chapter 1. I'll just try chapter 1, verse 17. Would someone read that? 1:17? So I don't do it. It's obvious. I have the Jerusalem Bible. It's in mine. Search for justice. Help the oppressed. Be just to these people who are helpless and who can be taken advantage of, the orphan and the widow. Then down to 1:21. Someone read 1:21. The city has become a harlot. A harlot is one who leaves, as one who would have other lovers. Right? God's lover, God's bride, the bride who married God at Mount Sinai has now run off and become a prostitute. By being once a people where there was justice, and now a city full of injustice, no more integrity. Then down to 1:22 and 23, your silver has turned into dross, your wine is watered, your princes are rebels, accomplices of thieves, all are greedy for profit and chase after bribes. They show no justice to the orphan. The cause of the widow is never heard. And then if you just move quickly over to chapter 5, verse 8. Woe to those who add house to house and join field to field until everything belongs to them, and they are the sole inhabitants of the land. Yahweh Sabaoth has sworn this in my hearing. Many houses shall be brought to ruin. And I wanted to move back to chapter 3, verse 14. You are the ones who destroy the vineyard and conceal what you have stolen from the poor. Did you ever steal something and hold it behind you so your parents wouldn't see it? Mm-hmm. I remember once hiding stolen candy in the buffet, and when my folks found it. You have stolen from the poor and conceal what you have stolen. By what right do you crush my people? Now, with whom does Yahweh identify here? Whom does he call my people? The poor, the oppressed. And as this movement goes on, you find that the poor had only their hope in Yahweh because the courts were messed up. Grind the faces of the poor. It is the Lord Yahweh Sabaoth who speaks. Well, let's just briefly look at these other themes now as we close today. Back to the second theme, and the reason I want to just show these themes is that you can read now the first part of Isaiah and see these themes coming in and out, kind of just weaving in and out of each other. Someone read chapter 1, verses 11 through 17. Someone read that one. It's kind of long, so read it real loud. I think there's some way that in our translations that how strong this language is, it's so hard for it to come through. Where God is really saying here, your worship life makes me throw up. Now, if I can get that as strong as I possibly can, God is saying, my stomach is sick. Why? Okay, these people have this idea that as long as we go to the temple and do all the liturgical ritual right, then anything can happen in the world and God will take care of us and God will protect us and God will bless us. If I'm religious, everything will work out okay. And God says, that makes me sick. Because it was a breaking of the covenant, because the people said, we can take over other people's land. We can take advantage of other people. But as long as we do all the churchy things right, God will never let us down. To the next thing. The problem the Israelite people had here, that remember I talked about this pocket of being a different people and the world around them. The religious understanding of the world around them was that religion and morality were never connected. The purpose of religion was to manipulate the gods so you would have fertility and good crops. And part of this being a different people is that this religion in this sphere is going to be totally different. It's going to be a passionate love relationship between God and his people that results in the people living together in peace. You know, totally different understanding of religion. And when you're in the sphere, you would constantly be seduced by this understanding of religion that was swirling among the people around you. And so they changed the understanding of temple worship from carrying on this love relationship with Yahweh to it becoming a manipulative, make Yahweh happy and he'll be good to us. See? Well, the next theme, Yahweh is ready to pardon. You know, in the centrality of forgiveness in the New Testament, you see the roots of that in Isaiah. Never, just as an order, I guess, never ever say that in the Old Testament you have a God of wrath and then in the New Testament a God of love. You could never say that and then read passages like chapter 1, 18 to 20. This was Lyndon Johnson's favorite verse. Do you remember? Come, let us reason together. Come now, let us talk this over, says Yahweh. Though your sins are as scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Though they be red as crimson, they shall be like wool. The picture here, we have to divorce ourselves from our Greek understanding of God as this kind of unfeeling being up in the sky that's kind of looking down on us. The Hebrew God isn't a God that is aching. Jim Fish called God a passionate Jewish lover. I think that was the words that struck me. And here is a God that's seeing this and saying, all you have to do is move one little foot and I'm jump in there and forgive you. All I want to do is forgive you. My heart just aches to forgive you. And you'll see that theme now running through Isaiah. And then destruction will surely come, but a remnant will be saved. Chapter 1, verse 8 and 9. This is the, your land is desolate. This is looking to the future now here. Your towns burnt down, your fields, strangers lay them waste before your eyes. All is desolation as after the fall of Sodom. The daughter of Zion is left like a shanty in a vineyard, like a shed in a melon patch, like a besieged city. Then notice this sign of hope, that there will always be a remnant. Had Yahweh not left us a few survivors, we should be like Sodom. We should now be like Gomorrah. Let's see, 125. Someone read 125. I know it's the purpose now for judgment here is what? Is it to wipe them out? You know, purifying, so that there'll be a new people. And it's in that new people now that Isaiah places the hope for the future. And you'll never find in the midst of this mess, in the midst of all of this discouragement and all of this hopelessness, you'll never find a more powerful and a beautiful word of hope than you do in the writing of Isaiah. Just an example of chapter 2, verses 2 to 5. In the days to come, the mountain of the temple of Yahweh shall tower above the mountains and be lifted higher than the hills, and all the nations will stream to it. Notice the universalism here already. All the nations will stream to it. Peoples without number will come to it, and they will say, come, let us go to the mountain of Yahweh, to the temple of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, so that we may walk in his paths, since the law will go out from Zion, and the oracle of Yahweh from Jerusalem. He will wield authority over the nations and rule between many peoples, and these will hammer their swords into plowshares, their spears into sickles, and nation will not lift sword against nation, and there will be no more training for war. Yahweh will come and rest on the whole stretch of Mount Zion, and on those who are gathered there, a cloud by day and smoke, and by night the brightness of a flaring fire. For over all, the glory of Yahweh will be a canopy and a tent to give shade by day from the heat, refuge and shelter from the storm and the rain. Now I want to set up this theme so we can pick up there tomorrow, that Isaiah was a person of the king in Jerusalem, and at that time there was this belief that the prophet Nathan, that God had spoken through the prophet Nathan to tell King David that his lineage would go on forever. His lineage would go on forever. And Isaiah understood that, and that's, we'll move us tomorrow. Why was he so close to the king in Jerusalem? Because it was with the king that the promise would rest, and the kingship of David would go on forever, and finally there would be that new Davidic king that would set up the new glorious kingdom of peace, where all the nations would flow to Jerusalem, swords would be made into plowshares, nations would not learn war anymore, there would be justice, there would be no more oppression, but people would live in peace. And this was a vision of the future. And now we'll move step by step as that community in suffering, in exile, in discouragement, and disappointments finally hammers out an answer to this question: how will that glorious future come to the world? So I'll leave you with that growing drama.